Well, it's wonderful to remember that God is faithful, isn't it? And it's a mark of God's faithfulness that he's given us this book. Let me just summarize the two main things that I think yesterday was all about. Ecclesiastes is here, coming in at the point where it looks as though the history of the people of God has arrived. And it's there to remind them that it hasn't yet. Because all is not as it ought to be. All is confusion. And for those who haven't got the eternal purposes of God in focus, this book drives you to get them in focus. It tells you that you've not yet arrived. And the same is true for us. We have not yet arrived, and we need to look at the world and remember that we haven't yet arrived, and that there's more to come. But for those of us who have got the wider picture clearly in focus, this book reminds us that the present time is not to be treated simplistically. It's not simple, straightforward. We can't remain detached from it and be godly. It's still messy, and we have to deal with it as a messy world. So there's two things. It points us to the fact that there are still things to happen, and it also helps us to do right in the present time when those things haven't happened yet. Now, let's go on to today. We're going to look this morning at two things. The first, we're going to look at a theme. One of the ways of dealing with a book like this is, because it's so repetitive, is to pick up the themes as they run through. And we're going to do that first with the subject of work. And later on, we're going to look again at a specific section of the book, the last two chapters. What do we think of work? It's the thing we don't want to do on Monday morning. It's the thing we love to stop doing on Friday. We say, thank God it's Friday, or people do anyway. Crunchy bars give you that Friday feeling, whatever it is. Something to do with stopping the grind of everyday life and getting into the grind of a crunchy bar. Some of us love work, don't we? Some of us hate it. For most of us, we do it, well, because we've got to do it. It's just the thing we have to do to earn a crust. Sometimes we like it, sometimes we don't. Most of the time, it's a mixture. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. But what we really think of work in our culture is demonstrated by the second question. You all know the second question. It's the second question that you ask when you meet somebody. What do you do? What do you do with yourself all the time? In our culture, more than anything else, our work is the defining feature of our lives. What we do is what we are. We see our work as defining our person. I'm a doctor, a stockbroker, a computer systems analyst, an unemployed football manager, a nurse, any old thing. That's what we are. Or that's who we say we are anyway. And of course, that's why unemployment troubles us so much. Because if we're unemployed, in terms of our culture, we are, well, who are we? We're nothing. We're not doing anything. Or not doing any work, as we define work. Now, it's perhaps not a surprise that we think like that, because work is the thing that most of us spend most of our time doing, or trying to do. And you'd expect the preacher to have an angle on work. And of course he does. In fact, it's one of his primary concerns. Look back to this verse that we've come to so often, chapter 1, verse 3. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Chapter 2, verse 3. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. He knows that we've got to do something. And he's asking, well, what's the point of anything that we do? And as with the other things in this book, his method is to have, yes, it's good, but not so good. Let's look at a few of the yes buts on work. First, it's essential. Chapter 4, verse 5. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. It's fairly straightforward, really. You've got to work or you'll be ruined. Chapter 10, verse 18. a man is lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. If you do nothing, entropy takes over. Chaos ensues. It will always do that. And yet, no matter what you do, it won't produce anything new. Again, chapter 1, verse 10. There will be no change. There will be nothing of which anybody can say, here is something new. It doesn't matter what you do, nothing new will be produced in the world. Second, it's worth having a shot at, because it may succeed. Chapter 11, verse 6. We'll look at this in more detail later on. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle. You don't know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. It's worth having a bash at things. It might produce something, but it won't produce anything lasting. Chapter 1, verse 11. Nothing will last. Every bit of human endeavour will disappear. Even the memory of the humans that did all those things will disappear. Work gives pleasure when it's being done. Chapter 2, verse 10. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward of all my labour. It was fun doing it. At least some of the time it was fun doing it. And yet sometimes it doesn't give pleasure. Chapter 5. Sorry, it's a bit of a paper chase, but it's just getting an idea. Sometimes it's not pleasurable. Verse 16 of chapter 5. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain, since he toils for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. Work is irritating, frustrating, makes you angry sometimes, doesn't it? And of course, in the end, it fails to satisfy. 2:11. When I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. I was after something, but I couldn't hold on to it. I couldn't catch it, whatever it was. Work is better with two. Two are better than one because they get a good return for their work, says chapter 4. But often it's driven by envy of others, sometimes those you work with. 4:4. I saw that all labour, all achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbour, keeping up with the Joneses. This too is meaningless. Now let's just look at some of that in greater detail. You've got the drift, haven't you? It's good, it's got good things about it, but it's not so good. It hasn't got good things about it. Let's look at chapter 2, because chapter 2 has a lot about work in it. Verse 3, he wants to see what's worthwhile to do under heaven during the few days of life. Life is short. What's worth doing when it's here? Well, he gets into everything. Real estate, horticulture, landscape gardening. He has many employees. He's very wealthy. He's into music and the arts. And into sex. He has everything. And it was fun while he did it, he says, verse 10. It was rewarding at the time, but when I stopped, verse 11, it all seemed futile. And my boss was saying to me recently how he'd reflected on how often it's when people retire that they realise the futility of everything they've done or been doing. Somebody else replaces you in your job. The work goes on as normal. You're not missed at all. What exactly did you contribute? You weren't useful for you, just for what you could do. Somebody else is doing it now. You were almost worthless. Another minion has replaced you. What's it been worth for you? Many people die very soon after retirement. It's quite striking. Many of the others recoil from the emptiness of it and get on with being busier than they've ever been before. Have you ever heard anybody say, I don't know how I ever found time for work once they're retired? Because they feel life even fuller than it was before. Because they can't bear the idea of the futility of everything they've done. Look at verse 18. Something else. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. I put all in all this work, And the person who picks it up is somebody who didn't work for it. I did the work. He's got the gain. And what's more, he might be a complete meathead. Look at verse 19. Who knows whether it'll be a wise man or a fool? He could be a complete idiot. And it's all his now. And I did it wisely. I put my best efforts into it. And it's meaningless, isn't it? What is the point of all the late nights, all the early mornings, all the missed time with family? What's the point, Mr. Baring, of all your hard work for many decades? Gone down the plug holes in a few weeks because one idiot did it all. Pointless, isn't it? What's the point of all that effort? Go on to chapter 4. So often achievement is motivated by wanting to do better than others. All labour and all achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless. If you didn't envy, you wouldn't have to work so hard, would you? So many lives seem to be taken over with the cares of work. I came through London on the train yesterday at about 8 o'clock, and the offices were still full of people. Friday evening, sat in front of the screens, hand to the phone. 8 o'clock on a Friday evening. What are they doing there? We never have enough, do we? We never have enough of just doing the work. We have to look better. We have to hang around late at night to be seen to be there. And that's the only reason. It doesn't matter if you do anything useful with the time. Just being seen to be there. And sometimes, well, look on to verse 8. I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil. Yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked. Why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? So often the aloneness is produced by the work, isn't it? People sacrifice everything. They miss time with their family. They miss time with their friends. By the time they get where they want to go, there isn't anything else to do anymore. And the irony of it is that people know that they're doing it. For whom am I toiling? Why am I doing this? This is meaningless, a miserable business, he says. I worked with a number of consultants when I was a doctor who hung around hospital late into the evening, not because they had anything useful to do there, but just because that was where they felt at home. Because everything else had been axed over the years, and that was the only place. That was the place where they found their identity. You know, a place where people get sick and die. Really ironic, isn't it? That's the place you feel at home, in the place of decay and destruction. Go on to chapter 5, verse 10. This is just straightforward greed, isn't it? Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. The people who earn most work hardest and work harder than all they earn. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. The more profit, the more people there are to soak up the profit. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? All you can do is look at it as other people benefit from it. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, verse 13. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. That phrase we looked at earlier on, what gain is there in all the work? Well, he says, no gain. Nothing's taken away. Everything's left behind. You know the story of the journalist who came to the funeral of a rich man and asked the vicar on the way out, how much did he leave? How much did he leave? To which the answer was, everything. Took nothing with him at all. Nothing is left. Well, it's depressing, isn't it? Why is work like this? Why is it like this? On the one hand, something we need to do. On the other hand, something which is totally frustrated. Well, we need to go back to the beginning of the Bible for that. We looked at this very quickly yesterday, so we don't need to spend much time. But to emphasize the point that we were made to be workers, to do something useful. Genesis 1:28, not just useful, but supremely useful. Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it. We're rulers of the world. At least that's what we were made to be. And yet, when we disobeyed, when our forefathers rebelled, our work was frustrated. Genesis 3, verse 17. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground. Work has been frustrated. The very thing that we were made for has been so turned over by God that we can't do it anymore. It's not possible to do it. It has become futile. Now, why is that important? Must have been done for a purpose. And I think the purpose is this, and I think it's exemplified in the story of Babel in Genesis 11. That's over on page 2 of your handout if you want to follow that. I think it's exemplified in this story of the Bible. Now look at what happens here. Verse 1, the whole world had one language and common speech, and as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, that is Babylonia, and settled there. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and bitumen for mortar, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. The essence of what goes on here is not that they're building a huge tower to reach up to God. That's not the point at all. The point is, they seek to define their identity in human endeavor without God. They want to build to make a name for themselves, work to give themselves significance, so that they won't be scattered through the earth. And Babel is the example in the Bible of misplaced human identity. And it's all tied up with work. Working to find your identity. And the importance of that is you see that because we were made for work, the area in which we most readily express our rebellion against God is in work. In labor without God. And the fact that our second question is always, what do you do, shows exactly that, that we have this tendency to define ourselves primarily in terms of what we do. That is what makes a name for ourselves, as it were. It shows that we value ourselves for what we do. What we do is who we are. And of course, if what we do is where we find our identity, then in the end, we will have valued ourselves as meaningless, futile, because work goes down the tubes at the end. To value ourselves in terms of what we do is to say, I am meaningless. And God has made it that way so that we won't do that, so that we won't value ourselves for what we do, so that we won't value ourselves independent of God. Because death, you see, will rub out everything we've ever done. Now beware, those of us who know that work is not the end, those people who say, well, I'll stop doing medicine to do something that lives for eternity. Just beware, those of us who do that, who knowing that secular work is not the end, find our identity in what we call spiritual work, the Read, Mark, Learn group, the Read, Mark, Learn program, St. Helen's Church, your summer camp, whatever it is. it's just a spiritual version or a spiritualized version of the same thing. Because everything that we build and make that we can see to give us identity will disappear. The cipher camp will disappear come the last day. Read, Mark, Learn will disappear. Certainly on the last day, if not long before. Only people last, not programs, not identifiable structures. None of that lasts. And to find our identity in structures that we build, in programs that we run, in things that we do, is futile. And there are Christian versions of that as well as pagan versions of that, as it were. Well now, what does the teacher recommend in view of all this futility of work? What does he recommend? Well, he says it many times through this book. It's a recurring suggestion or injunction. Chapter 2, verse 24. Man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. Enjoy it. You might as well enjoy it while it's here. You've got to do it. You can't avoid it. Enjoy it. This too, I see, he says, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? And there's a great irony in this. Look at verse 26. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. You see, it's not that these people are doing different things, this one who pleases God and this sinner, in inverted commas. They're doing the same things. But one remembers God and enjoys life and finds satisfaction in his work. And the other one, well, his life is really just storing it up to give it on to somebody else. Because there's no satisfaction there. There's futility there. And you'll know that that's true, isn't it? Some people are content with what they do. You don't have to be a Christian to be content with what you do. Some people are content with what they do, and our reader says that's a gift of God, contentment. Some people do exactly the same things and are totally uncontent. They never gain anything that satisfies them. They're really just storing it up for somebody else to pick it up, somebody else who might find satisfaction in it, gain in it. There's a great irony there, isn't there? Look at 3:22, where the message is the same. I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. It's what we've got to do. Might as well enjoy it. Chapter 5, verse 18. I realized that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given him, for this is his lot. Won't last long, but you've got to do it. Might as well enjoy it. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy him, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. It's good to be content. 8:15. I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. You know, it may not be brilliant, but nothing is obviously better. Chapter 9, verse 7. The last, and perhaps the emptiest of these. Go eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it is now that God favours what you do. Always be clothed in white. Always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labour under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you're going, there is neither working nor planning, nor knowledge, nor wisdom. Might as well enjoy it. Might as well do something enjoyable, because there will come the day when you won't be able to do anything. Well, remember verse 10. We'll come back to it later on. The New Testament makes exactly the same recommendation for the Christian. Don't need to turn to this, I'll just read it out. 1 Timothy 6:6. In fact, I do turn to this. That will be of great help, because there's something new I've noticed in this morning. 1 Timothy 6:6. Remember that. What's the question about work that Ecclesiastes has been asking? What's the gain? What's the profit? What's the use? And Paul says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. There is gain somewhere in being content, he says. Ecclesiastes can't see that. He can see it's worth being content, but in the end, what's the gain? Here, there is gain in being content. For we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. Same idea. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. So contentment is a good thing. It's something to be valued, something to be pursued, something that's the gift of God, something in which there is gain. It's a good thing. Yet you'd have to ask yourself, who can be content knowing that everything will be for nothing? I mean, what's the difference between being happy and sad if everything in the end disappears? If there isn't any meaning, if there isn't any significance, ultimately. Well, it's here that the New Testament picks up these ideas of vanity and meaninglessness and says, because of what lies beyond the grave, there is significance and there is an end to vanity. Now look first at 1 Corinthians 15. The kind of verse you'd skim over if you hadn't read Ecclesiastes. But now that you've read Ecclesiastes, it leaps out at you, doesn't it? Therefore, my dear brothers, stand firm, let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not futile, not in vain. There is a work that is not meaningless. There is something to do which will not have the stamp useless put on it at the end of time. Now that's brilliant news, isn't it? After all the futility of everything that we can see in the world that Ecclesiastes parades in front of us, he says there is something that is really genuinely not vain, useful, lasting. And the central point of this is that it's to do with having your identity in the Lord. The NIV is not quite clear here. The phrase in fact says, because you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. That is to say, for the person who finds their identity not in what they do, but in who they are because they belong to the Lord. For somebody who looks outside of themselves for their identity, their work becomes not useless. When you do it for yourself, with yourself as the centre, death renders it completely meaningless. But he says there is one outside the maze, and if your identity is in him, your activity in the maze is not a waste of time. Now we're going on, you'll split up into groups in a little while and look and think what labour in the Lord might entail. What exactly is that work that renders things not in vain? But the essence of it is, it's to do with finding your identity in something other than what you do. That is, in changing the second question. In changing the second question, not to what you do, but, well, who you belong to, I suppose. Who do you belong to? Do you belong to this world or do you belong to Jesus? That's the real definer of identity. Turn lastly to Colossians chapter 3. Paul again picking up a wisdom image. Remember Ecclesiastes verse 9, whatever you find to do, chapter 9, whatever you find to do, do it with all your heart, for in the grave where you're going, there's no doing of anything. Well, Colossians 3:23 says the same thing, but quite different. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, again, as working for the Lord, not for men, not for yourself. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. In other words, for everything you do, if done with the right motive, you have an inheritance to receive as a reward for doing that. There isn't a direct link between the thing that you do and the inheritance that you receive. It's not that your effort here works for you the inheritance or builds the inheritance. It's not like saving up money for your children. But for the one who belongs to the Lord, the doing of the work here gives you an inheritance. An inheritance is given to you as a reward for the way you do things here. That's remarkable, isn't it? You see, we know that whatever we do here will disappear, and this doesn't deny that. But he says that if you do it as to the Lord, you'll be given a reward quite different from what you built for doing that with the right identity in mind, not for yourself, but for the Lord. Well, folks, I think I've said all I've got to say. I don't know if anybody wants to ask any questions. I think perhaps the best thing we could do would be to split up and deal with some of these questions, which are pointing us really to what motivates us to do what we do. Why do we do what we do? What do we think the work of the Lord might entail? I think it might be useful to do that in little groups where you can discuss rather than just on your own, although you might want to do question two on your own.